Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.mpr.org and click Main Street. You can access Main Street Radio reports. You'll also be able to hear this broadcast on the Internet. That address again, www.mpr.org, and click on Main Street. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for this special Main Street Radio broadcast, which comes to you live from the NPR studios of KNBJ and KCRB in Bemidji. I'm Rachel Reby. We're continuing now this hour our conversation about deer hunting. If you're with us for the first hour of the show, you know we spent most of the time talking about the deer. Where are they? How many of them are there? How can we best manage the herd? This hour, we're going to switch our focus to the hunters, and we invite you to call us with your hunting experiences and observations. When the firearm deer season opens on Saturday, a half hour before sunrise, hunters across Minnesota will be ready and waiting in the woods and fields. Among them will be brothers Kevin and Corey Cease. Kevin is a funeral director in Bemidji. Corey works for the United States Forest Service in Grand Rapids. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, today. Rachel.
Hi, Kevin. Hi. Since you are the oldest of the two brothers,
and the smartest,
let's talk about the Cease family hunting traditions. How old were you, Kevin, when you first went out hunting?
I was 13 years old, kind of the traditional age for a lot of people in this area start going out. And I'll never forget, I was so nervous because here I was going to go to deer camp, and we've always kind of talked about it.
Sort of mystical.
It's deer camp, and it's capital D, capital C, and with the quotation marks around it. And we're just, I'm just excited. And also, that first year, Dad brought my, now Corey, all of us couldn't be here today, but my brothers are triplets. They're 2 years younger than I am, and Corey is one of the triplets. And I think that year, for some reason, why did Dad bring out all four of us to deer camp?
So you missed your chance to be the star.
I was
the 13
not quite
year old
the star. That's
hunt.
Right. That's right. But somehow, you know, they were there, and it was just kind of this rite of passage, and it was just a very exciting time.
So you felt grown up.
I felt very grown up. I did. I wasn't, but
Corey, when this time of year comes around, now I know you're wearing blaze orange, and of course this is radio, so as far as the listeners know, we're all wearing blaze orange. But you are wearing blaze orange. Do you get excited? Do things, your blood start kind of pumping at about this point, 2 days prior to opening?
Yeah, I think everyone does. I kind of wore it because it gets you in the mood to talk about deer hunting, I guess, and being that we're on radio, there's no visuals, so it just kind of stimulates.
Gets us going.
Get the blood going a little bit and get ready for Saturday morning.
How much do you love deer hunting? Is this a big deal to you, or if I said, let's go to the Mega Mall Saturday?
Well, yeah, I like it a lot more than the Mega Mall.
I'd be a negatory on that.
So deer hunting is a big deal in your life?
Well, I know people that it's a lot bigger deal. You know, I wouldn't die if I didn't do it, but it's something I look forward to all year and put preparation into out in the woods, scouting and thinking about.
You haven't seen his deer stand.
Have you ever missed a year, Corey?
Excuse me?
Have you ever missed a year of hunting?
Well, I probably miss more deer than some people have seen, so that's what I brag about anyway.
Did you ever miss a year going out, though, or do you hunt? Have you hunted every year since you were old enough?
I missed a couple years when I was in college. I kind of went through this idealistic phase where I wasn't sure about hunting and all this, but I still went to camp, and instead of hunting, I actually went out and cruised the timber out in our property, and I started getting hungry in the winter, and the meat was very economical, so I'm
you
back.
You went back to it, okay. Is it a big thing in your family? Is this when you think, Kevin, about family traditions, what you do on Thanksgiving and how you spend Christmas with your family, is deer hunting right up there?
Well, you know, we don't talk about it year-round as a family. But, you know, we have our normal lives and a lot of other family matters come into play. But then, you know, this time of year comes around, and I've been hunting since I was 13. I'm 37 now. So it's 24 years that I've been hunting. I can't think of anything I've done for 24 years in a row. I think I missed one or two when I was in college. But, and, you know, similar cast of characters every year. And there's this sense of tradition that is very comforting. You come in and you see people pretty much in the same place every year, and we always tell the same stories every year. We might add one or two every year to the lexicon of our camp, but there's this kind of techno speak or this kind of lexicon that we enjoy at our camp. And if you came in from the outside, you wouldn't talk about it. For instance, Corey, you know, my deer stand blew down. I told you that, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
But I checked out Merv's old stand.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know where that is. It's kind of about the old red stand. Of course, the red stand isn't there anymore. But you go through there. That's the one that Andre shot those $2 in opening morning, wasn't it?
Yeah. They had the scope hit him right between the eyes. So he was bleeding a little bit.
Yeah, but it's right by that other stand, you know, with that tall one. But that kind of blew down a couple of years ago. And so it's kind of all these things. Unless you have this history, you wouldn't know what we're talking about or where we're talking about.
So when you guys are out for your deer hunting expedition, do you talk about your other lives, Corey? Are you telling about your bad knee or what's going on with your job? Or when you get there, is it deer hunting time?
It's a little of each, I guess. You get some of that regular life out of the way so you can get into the mode. And, you know, you get into a deer hunting mode and you start talking deer hunting. And
it's kind of interesting, though, because
teasing people.
I'll go home and Ann will say, so, how Corey and Betsy doing? And, well, we got a deer. Well, didn't you talk about what they're doing in there? Well, he missed a deer.
So not too much conversation about outside life. Do you guys have, is it quite competitive when you go out with a group? Corey, are you like, if I could just get one and beat Kevin this year, if I could just pull ahead of him? Do you have, like, your long-term standings printed someplace, or does everybody have that memorized?
Funny you might ask that. We used to
last night compiling your head.
We used to have an old mobile home we'd pull in for deer camp, and we actually had everyone's name listed and every year and what they shot, a doe or a buck and whatnot. A few of us, it kind of broke up a little bit. We went out of state and they sold the trailer house, but it was right on the wall. So somebody started lying about what they had shot. You know, we just point out, no, you shot a doe that year, or you didn't shoot anything at all.
So, but now without this written record, we're trusting our memories, and so we can argue about this for hours, and it's great because we don't have to settle it. And sometimes the history gets bigger than ever, so you can always just kind of expand maybe what the truth might have been, just a little.
Although
that happens at deer
hunting. When I called you, Kevin, I said, are you a deer hunter? You're like, yes, I'm a huge deer hunter. And I said, well, then you've gotten like a deer every year? No, I can't remember the last time I shot a deer.
Well, that's why I was laughing when you asked Corey if it's competitive. Sure, it's competitive. It just doesn't take much to do better than me when I'm actually out in the woods.
How many deer have you shot in your entire career? Not shot at, but shot.
Do you run out of fingers and toes, Kevin? Or?
I think three. What do you think?
Yeah, Corey? Who's counting? Right?
Corey, does that mean you've shot more than three?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I probably have.
Like five?
Bigger
than a bread box?
Well, it's not written down, so, you know, there's probably a few dozen out there in the past few years. So, no.
He's probably shot, I bet you, 20.
It's hard to say, you know, a half dozen to a dozen.
We were thinking about this before you came in here. Tell me your most exciting story, Corey. Now, with no help here from Kevin.
Can I laugh?
Tell me, what was the most exciting thing that ever happened to you in the deer stand?
Well, I don't know if anything stands out more than any others, but it's fun when somebody, I get a deer, or if somebody else does and you're involved and you know, tracking it, you know, somebody might shoot a deer and come back to camp and say, well, we're going to go track it. You know, a lot of times you'll let a little time go by before going out and scaring it up, and it's kind of fun to be involved or going out to help Your brother dragged one in, and
you haven't had to help me very
I think
much.
The excitement is in all of that, actually, for me. So I do remember, you know, shooting a few bucks and felt really good. So, I mean, as far as the fulfillment, you know, you get all your scouting and put your stand out and everything clicks. You see the deer and you get it. And
so you were walking a little taller when you came home that year, Corey?
Oh, yeah, you always do.
King of the camp.
It's something, you know, opening morning on a lot of years we'll meet for lunch or something. And so everyone's kind of checking everybody out and seeing, well, do they have blood or deer hair on their feet or hands or whatever. And so it's kind of a joke to see how long you can go if you shot a deer without anyone realizing it. And if you can make it, you know, a lot of times you'll crack before then and you'll have to just blurt it out. So,
Kevin, your best story, your most exciting time.
I haven't had that many exciting times because mine all revolve around other deer people else have shot. There's one time where pretty much there's a couple years where Corey kind of alluded to it, where people were out of state and they just couldn't make it back. And so it was only me, my brother, Kent, and I. That was it. That was our deer camp. And so
the Thies family
diminished
considerably.
Exactly. Yeah. But we had to keep our you know, stake out our territory, you know, and keep doing what we had to do. And so we you know, we didn't stay out there. Usually we bring a tent and stay right at the site, and it's kind of fun. It's a combination of public and private land, and so we're just kind of, you don't have to move anywhere, you're right there, and but this time we since it's only two of us, we're not going to camp out there. It's a lot of work to do that. And so it's Sunday night, opening weekend, and you know, it's just us two, and we can party hunt. And all of a sudden, just before dark, I hear like three shots by Kent's stand, and it just started to snow. And he just had built the stand. We call it now the old buck stand because he had stolen it from Corey since Corey was gone, right?
Yeah, and then the year I came back, he shot 3 8-pointers out of it. Yeah. And that really, I wanted to stand back then.
That's
but
right. But now it's Kent's stand. But Corey will call it the old buck stand, so, because you have to label the stands. And it's dark now, and it had just been clear cut probably, about 4 or 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years before that, and so there are these saplings, these popple saplings, and it's dark. And we had compasses, but that doesn't always help you in the dark with snow, because you look up, we had flashlights, and the snow was going all around us. We're dragging these. He had shot two, a buck and a doe. Shot my doe tag, which I had gotten. And
you
I was
so happy
off.
To have
well,
something
okay.
to put that tag
okay, but
on.
We still had another weekend, and that means I don't get to hunt, because we filled up our tags. So thanks a lot, Kent, already. I'm already torqued off at him. And then we got to drag these things out of his stand, which is way back in the woods, through these saplings that are just barely maneuverable through. And then halfway through, because of the snow, he kind of got lost. And so we're kind of making circles, dragging these deer.
You were sorry you missed that. Year,
and it took us at least an hour to drag these things out. And then finally get out there and we'll go... And we load him up in his pickup, and he got stuck in the pickup on top of it. And then his pager went off because we needed to go back home. Everybody was wondering where we were. It was way after dark. They kind of checking up on us. And we didn't have a cellular phone back then. And so it was hung up in this log, and all we had was this little hatchet. And it was this huge popple log. And we spent another hour and a half chopping this darn log down so we could get out of the woods. Finally did. So that's not really an exciting deer hunting story, but I never let my brother Kent forget that. So.
When you guys go out, do you kind of say to yourselves, well, don't shoot my deer. I don't care if I go home with nothing. Don't shoot it.
I think when we were younger, it was a lot more competitive. But as the years go by, you're just happy that somebody else can get a deer and yep. have the experience. And it's not quite that competitive now. But when we were younger, we definitely were, you know, that's my deer I saw first or whatever, but it's changed a lot since then.
Again, try to picture this. Here's our father who has, at that time, I'm 2 years older, so when my brothers first hunted, they were 13, I was 15. He has 4 kids in the woods with guns. Can you imagine that?
I'd be in that. I'd be in that trailer, staying real low underneath the windows.
And amazingly, though, we all made it. And I was carrying the old gun. We've got this gun, and Brett's going to get it this year, but to use. But my brothers ended up with a single shot 30-30. How well did that shoot, Corey?
Well, we'd go out before season and shoot them, and have a hard time hitting a target.
wasn't the best sighted gun ever. So you started when you're 13. Is that legal in Minnesota that at 13 you can go out and hunt? If you've had, do you have to have a class first?
You have to have your your hunter safety class.
Okay. Kevin, you brought your son Brett along today. Brett is 13 years old, as in the seventh grade in Bemidji. He's skipping school today to talk to us about deer hunting. Brett, this is your first hunt this year, so you've gone through your class. Are you ready to go out with these guys, Brett?
Well, I guess. I'm still thinking about it, but yeah.
Tell me what you're most excited about.
Well, probably what every boy is interested in is just getting a buck the first year and bragging about it the rest of deer camp.
Are you kidding, Brett? You hear your dad, so you'll be bragging about the rest of your life. This may have to stand you for the next 30 years. So when you hear grown-ups say, like your dad, I don't really care if I shoot anything. I don't care. I just want to go out in the woods. You would say what?
I care. Want to get a deer.
You care desperately at 13.
Well, not desperately, but yeah, still.
So what time will you be getting up on Saturday?
4 to 5, maybe.
Yeah, before.
And have you ever been to deer? Did you get to go to deer camp?
Yeah,
even with?
I've been there. My dad's been taking me since I was 3 or 2, so I know the setting and everything, but this is the first year I'm probably going to handle a gun by myself, so it's pretty exciting.
And do you have your own gun, Brett, or are you using this old...
I'm using the traditional one.
What is it, Brett?
It's the Winchester Lever Action 30-30.
And so this year, will you be going to your own stand, or when you're 13,
no.
Do you go to a stand with your dad?
My dad's still going to watch him.
We talked about this, and he's actually been in the stand with me before, and so we know about this. But this year, when I'm in with him, I'm just going to be just kind of his shadow and just kind of be with him. He's using this gun that's my grandfather, his great-grandfather used, my father used, all of my brothers and I used. And so... I'm just going to be kind of his shadow there and just kind of, I think it might be a little bit easier. Plus, it'll make us, you know, kind of bonding experience there. You won't be so lonely in the woods.
But can you talk when you're on the deer stand?
Oh,
or is that totally taboo?
No.
Can't talk in the woods.
Sacred.
That's right.
Corey, I think you'd have an easier time with that than your older brother. Would I be right about that? That's got to be the big challenge for you, Kevin, is sitting up there silent.
Well, actually, it's funny you should mention that because... For me, obviously, I do like to talk a lot, but when I'm forced to sit alone, I really hesitate to call it a sacred experience or a spiritual significance, but it's a time of year when there is no phones, there's no kids. Well, this year, somebody will be bugging me, but there's no outside interference, and I can just sit there for hours and hours, no TV, no radio, no nothing, and you just... It reaches inside of you. Just it touches something very, very, very old and ancient inside of you, and it just silence is good. I found that out. There's solitude, which is a very good thing. You're not alone. But that means you're lonely, but solitude means that you've got to focus, and it's exciting. And then buck fever usually sets in somewhere that is one of the neatest rushes that you'll ever get in your whole life. This adrenaline surge that you I hear something. It could be. And you start looking, and your heart rate starts getting a little bit bigger, and you hear something crashing a little bit farther. And it could be anything. You don't know what it is, and it might come later. It might come later. And then it might go away, and then pretty soon everything starts looking like a deer. You see twigs rustling in the grass, and pretty soon they're antlers, and you see some brown, and you can swear it's a deer.
Or a squirrel, whatever.
Brett, do you have... the first dibs on anything that comes by your stand? Was that the agreement you made with your dad that you'll go up with him in a stand?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you get first shot.
Yeah, pretty sure.
Brett, tell me, in school, Are other kids talking about deer hunting? Because you're in the seventh grade and you're all probably 13 years old or almost 13 years old, are your friends, are they excited about hunting, or is hunting not a big deal for today's 13-year-old?
Well, as a matter of fact, this lunch period, I heard some people asking, well, who's going deer hunting this season, and what time are you getting up, and all those questions. So, yeah, it's not the biggest deal right now, but some people are talking about it.
And do you feel, Brett, like after Saturday you're going to be a man, or you're kind of going to go out as seventh grader, but you'll be coming back whether you or do you have to shoot something before you really feel like you've crossed the great veil?
I probably have to shoot something before I cross the threshold, and yeah.
But some stories wouldn't hurt.
No, I could make up a couple along the way, yeah.
Are you the first of the Cease grandchildren to go out hunting now? Are you
yeah.
the oldest of the grandchildren?
Yeah, my
in the family?
Cousins are only 2 and 4, so I'm going to be the first one.
Kevin, you also have a daughter. Will she, when she turns 13, will she join the group?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? My feeling is if she chooses that she wants to be a part of this whole experience, I would love to invite her into that whole process.
Has she been out to deer camp?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. yeah, she's been out to deer camp too. My spouse feels a little bit differently than I do, and I'm sure we'll come to terms somehow, but I'll probably leave it up to Allison. So.
Brett, do you have any concern that you might see the deer, you might be there in the deer stand, and then at last minute you just think, I can't do it, I just can't do it, or is that not going to be happening?
Well, it depends on what happens during that time. I'd pretty try desperately to get the buck or whatever the deer I saw, but if somebody was in the way or something like that, no?
We've talked a lot about safety, and that's especially when you bring a new hunter in, that's something
yeah.
that's a big concern. We have had people in our deer hunting party in the past that haven't observed some of our, what we are really very, very strict and very, very fussy about safety, because it is a big deal, and they haven't been invited back. So Brett is just making just an allusion to that. If that's a good shot, take it. But if you're even questioning it, just don't worry about it. It's not worth taking a shot.
Now, a story in the Minneapolis Tribune this morning talking about 12 to 17-year-old hunters, twice the accident rate of the hunting population in general. Does that scare you as a dad?
It does. It really does. But since I'm going to be with Brett this first year, it concerns me less because I'll be right with him. And also, again, Brett's seen what this gun can do. We've taken
it out and shot it into puddles and trees.
And he's aware of the great danger. And then I get to tell him my story when I turned 13. I forgot the part where the same very gun, I wasn't really totally aware of how it worked, and I was ejecting the lever action, and then I'd put the hammer down because the hammer would be back. I mean, worried about safety. And then I'd put it back, and then I'd do the lever action, eject the shell. And my brother Kurt was there, and he's bending down to pick up the shells as I ejected it, and the hammer slipped out of my thumb, and it just went off as he's bending down to pick up another foot. We'd be talking a lot different. So that has imprinted me ever since. I mean, that was an extreme.
Imprinted everybody, I think.
Everybody in our camp. And in fact, Brett, how many times have you told me to tell that story?
About close to the umpteenth time.
So safety is a very, very critical factor in our family.
And as far as success for Brett, I'll probably take him out so he can actually get a deer rather than just go out with his dad. So
that might be easier. Corey, what do you think about in the deer stand? So, like, if you guys get up at 4 or 5 and you're in your stand a half hour before sunrise and you stay there straight through until lunchtime, or do the hardcore ones, do sometimes you just stay there all day till sundown?
Yeah, we usually bring a lunch with, and if it's nice weather or if you just feel like staying, you stay, and, the code is not to bother someone, if they don't come in for lunch. And I end up thinking about a lot of things in your life and going through a lot of it and planning and thinking about whatever issues are going on in your life at the time, or you just might be enjoying the scenery.
So is it a spiritual experience? I hear people say that over and over again, that when they go out hunting, and I don't know if it's the fact of being in the woods or if it's because it's perhaps the first time in months we have stood still long enough to think a cogent thought. I don't know what it is, but what's your thought on it?
Well, I think maybe for some people it might be the only time they're out there in the woods and really taking a chance to really soak it in, and it probably is a lot different experience where I tend to be out there a lot more than that and kind of hoping for a deer and thinking about, well, if this doesn't work out here, where else am I going to go tonight or tomorrow morning? Maybe in the early years it might have been a little more, but it's less so now.
For me, what Corey was getting, I don't get a lot of chance just to be out in the woods alone. And for me, I end up thinking about creation and, gosh, what a neat thing nature is and how lucky we are to have lived in a world that God's created like this. And you get to observe nature in its full force, and something comes along and you aim a gun at it. It's kind of an oxymoron. I do realize I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth. But.
Well, we've heard today people calling up and saying, how could you ever deer hunt? And if you are a conservationist, you cannot be a hunter. If you are an environmentalist, that does not go along with being a hunter. Your take on that, Corey?
Well, I guess I look at it as if you're out there to take an animal and to eat the meat, it's, you know, a lot of people are out there eating hamburgers and eating animals they never saw or never saw killed, and this way, it kind of, when you eat that meat, you know exactly what happened. And, you know, as a meat eater, I tend to appreciate what I'm eating a little differently than going to a supermarket and buying a bunch of ground up meat and thinking it just comes in white packages.
So not unlike the experience of the gardener who picks the tomato and comes in and slices it, as opposed to just throwing it in the brown paper bag with the rest of the groceries and bringing it home.
Well, it's a little different. You know, a big brown-eyed animal is a little different than a vegetable. And I think most hunters, whether they admit it or not, probably have some period of remorse after they kill an animal and go there to go through the other process of field dressing it and all. And every time you field dress an animal, you're probably thinking, you know, I personally think about, you know, what it is I just did, and because, you know, you get inside field dressing an animal and you're right in the thick of it. So, but, you know, it's all the process. You know, I love to eat the meat and love sausage and jerky and.
And we've talked about this too. A lot of times, we've kind of grown up with this tradition, and for us, I mean, there's two different things. There's the tradition, there's the hunt part that I think, you know, we're talking about. But there's when you grow up, it's kind of normal. Everybody kind of does it, and you don't think about it very much. It's just something that you do, and it's a part of our annual, you know, calendar of events. And we just know it's deer hunting. This is what we're going to do. We're going to get together. I'm going to see that same ugly hat that you're going to wear every year, and we wear the same costumes, if you want to call it, every year. And it's there's something comforting in that. And then listening to it, we have a brother, Kent, who tells the same story. It takes him half an hour to tell it every single year.
We warn people, and I actually time them, and it takes him a half hour to tell
it. Is this the story of the time you almost killed him?
No. This is another story, but we got him down to 20 minutes last year, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's when he was hunting in Wyoming, and it's just a long story.
It's a long story.
We have 25 minutes now before 1 o'clock. Dr. Dwight Fultz, a psychology professor at Bemidji State University, is joining us now in the studio to give his perspective on the culture of deer hunting. And Dr. Fultz, you also were from the Bagley area, along with the Seath brothers, and you are a lifetime hunter as well. We have talked today with their own particular experiences about hunting. Do you find those to be universal in a sense?
Well, I'm thinking of all kinds of hunting stories of my own. So
it brings that out.
And yes. And listening to the stories of near death and a lot of years without getting deer, as far as my own experience, it feels universal. And lore nationwide does seem to hunting lore seems mm-hmm. to include a lot of the same kinds of stories, the same kind of meaning. I don't think there's a lot of variability here in the United States in hunting experiences.
Why is it so important? Why is hunting so important? We talk about it as a ritual and a tradition. Why are those important in our lives?
Well, I guess I would talk about those a little differently. The word ritual actually implies something of spiritual or religious significance. It's associated with procedures that have ceremonial sacred value and so on. We use the word ritual sometimes loosely, I think, to talk about habits or repetitive behaviors or events, things that we just do. But it implies there's a meaning there and that we tap into something bigger than our own immediate experience. And as Kevin and Corey were suggesting, there is something very, very solemn and meaningful about not just going out into the woods, not just getting away from offices and children and becoming inaccessible in some ways to the outside world, enjoying nature and so on. All of that's solemn, sort of back to nature, something you'd get in the Boundary Waters, which has its own spiritual value. But you're also out there, at least in part, to take the life of an animal, to contribute to the family larder, to be a provider.
So this hunter-gatherer, it feeds into it. That's all part of it.
Yeah, I don't think we even need to think of this hunter-gatherer a tradition or need or ethic as a primitive sort of thing. I did grow up on a farm as well, and I remember feeling sorry for my friends who didn't have the experience of raising their own food.
Were that far removed from it?
They were far removed, as Corey was suggesting. This food chain that we're a part of. I had to remove the heads from chickens in order to eat them, and they thought that was awful. I remember a friend who was horrified when she discovered where milk came from, because it was so gross, as she put it. But I think there's a sense of responsibility, a sense of rightness in participating sort of close to the action in the food chain, and there's something solemn about taking this life, about doing it in a safe manner, about doing it ethically, about participating in a responsible way. The grown-up, you know, as Brett is anticipating, the grown-up responsibilities that come along with it, I think, are powerful.
I want to talk to you about those rites of passage, but first we're going to go to a very patient John calling us from St. Paul. Good afternoon, John.
Man here. Hello?
We've got you on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Thanks. I just wanted to address the issue of not getting it. To me, wilderness is a religion, and I've hunted for 25 years. I've taken a trip around the world, and it's a religion on the decline. Worldwide, there's a decline of wilderness and people that harvest it and commune with it. And it seems to be that this century is a century of moving away from wilderness towards the city and technology and corporations who are taking control of a lot of our wilderness. And I just think it's a great loss. And our religious people, the Jews, look at the Christians and say, I don't get it. And the Muslims look at the Christians and say, I don't get it. And city people look at wilderness people and say, I don't get it. It's just a big kind of a Buddhist thing where if you harvest this deer, it doesn't die. It lives in you. It's a bigger thing than we are. And from the religious aspect of it, I think of the wilderness as my religion, and I kind of mourn the loss of the wilderness worldwide. It's happening everywhere. And the people that harvest it are being pushed out into city jobs where they're really, their life is less of a life. And if you can get out and be in wilderness in any way, you know, the deer hunters, the fishermen, or any kind of a wilderness communal experience, I think it's great for individuals. It's great for their soul, and it's a spiritual experience. So I'm all for it in any way that you can commune with that beauty that's in wilderness. That's my experience with it.
Dr. Fultz, let's talk about this. How common is that to think of wilderness or hunting actually as a form of religion?
Well, I'm not an expert in all the forms of religion. Certainly, nature has been worshipped. People feel often spiritual in one sense when they get into nature, when they interact with it. I think nature is powerful. I think it's beautiful. And certainly there are religions that exalt certain parts of nature and worship them. But again, I'm not familiar with the various religions, so I couldn't name specifics. The tendency, though, to worship something that's powerful and beautiful and beyond our control, I think, is universal. We don't. It may be a reaction against the concept of God, a person, so that we worship nature. I'm not sure.
Let's go back to the earlier point I wanted to make. We heard Brett Ceason here, a 13-year-old, going out for his first hunt. And we heard from his dad, Kevin, when he was 13 years old and went to the woods. And what a important rite of passage that was for him. Do we have a serious lack of rites of passage in our culture now? I hear people often saying, you know, when is it you get to be a grown-up? We don't have any formalized ceremony for the most part. Are these rites of passage quite important? What function do they serve?
Well, I think we come up with rites of passage, and I'm not quoting research here or anything. These are observations. Every group seems to have rites of passage. If you live in a big city, if you live in another country, if you don't hunt, if you do, you will have rites of passage, and every group seems to have theirs, whether it's getting a driver's license or having children or something else. In this area, hunting is one of those. I think we will have rites of passage. We need markers and methods by which to confer status and maturity and responsibilities on people. So I think we'll find them wherever we are. Hunting is just another one that we seem to prefer here in northern Minnesota.
We've talked about earlier in this show going out into the woods, getting away from your regular life, not having the laptop computer, not having the TV, the VCR, the Nintendo, all the sort of electronic gadgets and gizmos that become such a part of everyday life. You hear people constantly saying, I can't think if there's not some other noise in the background, if I don't have the radio on, if I don't have the TV on. What function does it serve going away into the woods and hearing the silent? Do we see a rebirth of conversation in these outings when people go out and must speak to each other instead of watching a screen together?
Well, one of the observations that I've made over the years is that there are a lot of groups that seem to go to the woods, pull the camping trailer out there, or to go to the hunting shack, who very fiercely protect their culture they've developed, which is a sort of inaccessible culture. And when somebody brings high-tech equipment, someone brings a phone or a pager, as I guess Corey had, or has access to the outside world, that there are sanctions in place by the group, that this isn't the way we do things. We don't bring TVs. We don't bring radios. We talk with each other. We tell jokes, stories, lies, whatever we want to tell. Many groups seem to develop or carry out something that I think is as close as some of us come to an oral tradition, in that, in Cease's case, they marked down deer that were gotten, and then they sold the house, so now they can go on with the tradition. And oral traditions sometimes encapsulate values of a group or almost caricaturize what this group stands for. The stories that are told year after year are stories that are funny for a reason, because maybe someone stumbled over some group norms, or because they are powerful, danger was involved, or because of a particular incident that stands out in that group's collective mind as being important. And so we develop an oral tradition. We need to tell the stories. In Cease's case, Kent probably needs to tell this story. It wouldn't be hunting season without it, even though anybody could tell it. They've heard it enough times.
Do we love the repetition of it? I've heard deer hunting groups who say, we have the same hot dish, always the Friday night before deer hunting. We get up at the same time always on opening day. We eat the same things. I heard Kevin and his brother talking about wearing the same crummy old hat that they wore every year. The son now is hunting with the same gun that his father had his first hunt, the grandfather's gun, the great-grandfather's gun. Is repetition important to adults as much as it is to kids? It seems like children love to do the same thing, to know, yes, we're always going to have wild rice soup on Christmas Eve because, Mom, you made it last year and the year before, and I guess that qualifies as a tradition. We know it's important for kids. Is it important for adults?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of two answers to that. One, yes, it is important. Repetition is efficient. Habits are efficient. At the same time, one thing that ritual-type behaviors actually do, habits with meaning, if I could say it that way, one thing they seem to do is to easily help us to connect with this bigger context we belong to, the meaning of the event. And whether it's a religious event or a hunting kind of event, there's a deeper meaning behind it. There are values, there's family history, there's a sense of rootedness. We have names for places, names for stories. We have categories for our fellow hunters that tie us back often into a history, our roots. Let me give an example that I'm thinking of as I'm saying this. The land that I hunt on with my family, I have a fairly large family, and our extended family hunting group gets to be fairly large. It's land that's now public land on which my father was born. And my grandparents homesteaded on this land. My grandfather cleared with an axe and horses the field that is there. And my father was born out there in the woods. We can see the hole in the ground where the cellar was. The house was burned down years later. And when we hunt over this land and when we tell stories about it, we know the land. We know the hills. We know the swamps. We know the old roads. And we have names for them from long, long ago. And people that my dad knew as a child seem as familiar to us as if we knew them personally. And that sense of being rooted, of belonging to the land, to that place, in this part of the country, is very, very strong, especially during hunting season. That's where we go back to those roots. And the stories serve that purpose, and the repetition easily connects us.
We have spoken during much of our show today to men about deer hunting. It's important to point out in the show that deer hunting is not just for men. About 5% of the state's deer hunters are women, and their numbers are growing nationwide. The number of female firearms hunters has jumped almost 30% since 1990. Jean Bergerson of Grand Rapids has hunted for 30 years. She joins us today to talk about a new national program designed to teach women how to hunt and fish. Welcome, Jean. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
You're the state coordinator for the Becoming an Outdoor Woman program. What's that all about?
Well, it's about getting more women involved in what have been traditionally male sports, hunting and angling. And we do workshops and formats in which we want to teach and familiarize women with hunting and shooting sports, angling and other related activities to that. And we also do canoeing and nature photography and some of the more non-consumptive traditional outdoor activities.
You heard the statistics, and you know it anecdotally yourself, that there are more women that are interested in hunting and deer hunting. Big game, going after big game. Are you personally seeing more women in the woods? Is it not unusual in 1997 to see a party come through and to see a woman as part of it, or to see a party of all women?
Well, it's interesting because I'm just starting to see parties of mostly women or all women. I've bull hunted for a number of years and hunted by myself, and I'm just seeing women reach a comfort level with being in the woods and with hunting where they will go and do those things by themselves rather than always needing to be part of the traditionally male family group or doing it with a significant other.
I've seen statistically that most women get into hunting because they're either born into a family or they have a husband who takes them hunting, teaches them hunting, or a boyfriend. When women don't have those opportunities, they didn't grow up in a hunting family, and whether they're men in their life or not, they're not learning it from them. Is that why the workshops, that there has to be an opportunity to teach these skills if people don't have another way to learn them? You can't just get a gun and head out for the woods, I wouldn't think.
Well, it's kind of interesting because we have women from 18 to 80 in the workshops, and some of them are women who traditionally hunted in the way that you're talking. They were small children and started out like I did with a family group, and then got into those other rituals of life that Dr. Foltz was talking about, having children, raising families, working. And some of them, once they retired, said, you know, I really remember as a kid doing these things, and I would like to go back to them. Some of them are women that are single-parent moms that are saying, geez, I've got a son or a daughter at home that would really like to do these things, and I'd really like to learn about them so I could go with them or so I could teach them. And others are just women that are kind of striking out independently and saying, geez, this seems like fun. I'd like to give it a try. So women approach things in different ways. I was just talking to a couple of fellows yesterday, and I said, guys would go to the sports shop and buy a gun and buy a license and say, well, I'm going to do it. And women say, I'm going to go to the library and read about it, or I'm going to take a workshop, or I'm going to go to a clinic, and I'm going to learn about it, and then from there I'll decide whether I'm going to really do it or not.
So a whole different way of learning about it.
It's a different approach, and I think part of that has been the insecurity of not traditionally doing those things. And so you don't feel like innately you ought to be able to go out and deer hunt. So you research it, and you want to make sure that you do a good job of what you're doing, because women do not do it for the same, I hate to call it macho reasons, but they're not as competitive about their sports as men are. And so they do it more because they enjoy nature and because they want to do some of the other things that are associated with hunting rather than just harvesting the animals.
Jean, how did you get into hunting?
I get into hunting, it's interesting, the same way that the other folks did. I was raised on a farm, and killing animals for food was part of the culture of the farm. Whether it was the chickens Dr. Foltz was talking about, or shooting the squirrels so they didn't raid the corn crib and make a mess out of our crop that we needed for the cattle for the winter. And a lot of us that were raised on farms got into hunting out of necessity. And then in adult life, realized that that was our connection to nature and wanted to maintain it for that reason.
We have a phone call on the line. Pat, you can go ahead with your question or comment if you would.
Okay. I was just chewing my lunch when I found funny. I wonder what it is that's caused these men to doubt their masculinity so much that they feel that they have to go out and kill something, a creature that's not threatening them, and they don't need for food. I just heard that women like to do it too. I think that's more an artificial thing. The women, it's rather new for women to do it in great numbers. And they're talking about being alone in the woods as one with spiritual experience, being one with nature. You don't have to kill something to be alone in the woods and have a spiritual experience. As for food, there is no, I can't see any opposition between eating meat that you get commercially and not wanting to kill deer, because you don't need the deer for food. We can go to the store and buy meat. And I'm a carnivore. I don't think it's wrong to eat meat, but you don't need to do this. So I just wonder what has happened to these men, modern men, that they feel they have to do this. I'd like to hear some theories about this besides the wonderful traditions.
Jean, let's have you address that. why the need to hunt? Do you feel a need to hunt, or is it like any other activity? You just enjoy hunting.
Well, I'd like to make probably three comments on that. One is it's not new to women. It's actually very old to women that traditionally frontier women did hunt because their husbands were off trapping or doing other things, and they hunted to provide food for their families. Now, the caller's point is that we no longer need to do that. That's true, but one of the reasons that I hunt is it's far healthier food than you can buy in a grocery store. It's far lower in cholesterol, and I honestly and seriously enjoy eating wild game far more than anything I can buy in a grocery store.
Jean, have you been surprised by the interest shown in your Becoming an Outdoor Woman workshops? And you have for a year. Minnesota is one state chapter in a national. This is a national organization. We need to make that clear. Have you been surprised by the interest shown?
Yes. Nationwide, we have about 10,000 women that have participated in the program since 1991. And I think it's growing. And I think that the reasons it's growing is a couple of things. More and more women are finding out about the program, but also more and more women are looking for ways to get out of the urban community and do that reconnection with nature that we were talking about.
Will you be out in the woods or in the fields on Saturday?
I have been out in the woods and fields, and I will not be out this Saturday deer hunting. I no longer firearms hunt in the traditional season. I hunt with primitive weapons. So for the last several years, I've done my deer hunting either with a bow and arrow or with a muzzle loader. And interestingly enough, I just returned from a deer hunt in Alabama, which was an all-women's hunt with 27 other women. And it was the first time I had been at deer camp with 27 women. And there were some real interesting observations that those of us that traditionally are part of a all-male camp made on that hunt.
Thank you for joining us for this special Main Street Radio broadcast. We'd like to thank all of our guests today, Joe Wood, Jim Bryan, Kevin, Brett, and Corey Cease, Dwight Fultz, and Jean Bergerson, as well as our callers. Our St. Paul producer for the show was Sarah Meyer. Mel Summer and Kate Smith were the executive producers. Our engineer today was Rick Hibzinski on location and Randy Johnson in St. Paul. We'd like to thank Christy Booth and Ellen Barr of KNBJ KCRB for their hospitality in bringing you this show from Bemidji. Thanks also to our site producer, Joe Kelly. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street Radio team is Mark Stile, Catherine Winter, Leif Enger, Dan Gunderson, and myself, Rachel Reby. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.mpr.org and click Main Street. You can access Main Street Radio reports. You can also hear this program on the Main Street website. The address again is www.mpr.org and click on Main Street. MPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening.